Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Mbuga.
UN forces are a small portion, but they are better than nothing. And they've been very helpful to the Congolese army. For instance, Sake would have fallen on Wednesday if it was not for the involvement of MONUSCO, because MONUSCO was fighting alongside the Congolese army.
Staff and vehicles of a UN peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo is attacked in the capital Kinshasa as the worsening eastern security crisis fuels a backlash against the mission.
Killings are on the rise. Kidnapping is on the rise. If heavily guarded government officials are kidnapped, then what about the ordinary civilian? People are moving, but they can't move freely.
Cameroon separatist fighters claim responsibility for the killing of four government workers, including a policeman abducted in the country's restive English-speaking northwest region.
We might have to look at how we can integrate our natural grass, indigenous grass, like buffalo grass is also good for livestock. So if you have bands of jankau grass intercropped with indigenous grass, that might reduce the risks of losing the rangeland biodiversity or even the farmland biodiversity.
And six African Union member states discuss Africa's feed and fodder crisis in Nairobi, Kenya. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The head of the UN peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo said its staff and vehicles were attacked in the capital Kinshasa on Saturday as the worsening eastern security crisis fuels a backlash against the mission. Reuters reports crowds on motorbikes gathered in the riverside Gombe district where the UN mission known as MONUSCO and many embassies are located. A number of the mission's vehicles were torched, said MONUSCO's head, Bintou Keita, in an online post. The Ivorian embassy also said one of its vehicles had been vandalized in Kinshasa and described indiscriminate attacks on vehicles belonging to embassies and international organizations. An advance by rebel group M23 that threatened the strategic eastern seat of Goma in conflict-torn North Kivu province has aggravated a decades-old security and humanitarian crisis. Clashes between the rebels, the armed forces, and self-defense groups that support the army have escalated in recent weeks, forcing over 135,000 more people to flee to perceived areas of greater safety near Goma, the UN humanitarian agency OCHA said on Thursday. MONUSCO has been deployed in eastern Congo since taking over from a previous UN operation in 2010. Its mandate includes supporting the Congolese government's effort to stabilize the region, but in recent years, it has faced sometimes violent protests linked to perceptions it has not done enough to stem the eastern bloodshed. Mulenga's Hindura is the president of the Center for Political and Strategic Studies in DRC and a former spokesperson for President Joseph Kabila. He says citizens are frustrated by the failure of the government to protect the sovereignty of the country.
I think it's a tragedy what is happening in the capital city of the Democratic Republic of Congo. We've been following events, as you know, as they unfold in the capital city, and I think it's a tragedy.
Normally, these kind of protestations would be where the conflict is in the eastern part of the country. Do you think people are so frustrated now in the capital?
Obviously, people are very frustrated with the way the war is being conducted. You know, people are very frustrated that to this point, the government is not able to protect the sovereignty of the country. You know, people are very frustrated by the continued aggression in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. You know, but also the way the government is becoming very irresponsible. The way they are communicating to the population about this is very, very uncalled for. And I think the government needs to learn how to return themselves and invest their efforts more on the battleground rather than trying to incite people to attack people who have nothing to do with this war.
Talking of the battleground, there's a lot of militias and other forces in the eastern part of the country. The South African Community Forces had to leave. Now the people don't like, it appears, don't like the UN peacekeeping force. Do you think the Congolese government has the wherewithal to fight off these myriad militias?
First of all, I don't think the problem here is the UN force in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The UN forces are a small portion, but they are better than nothing. And they've been very helpful to the Congolese army. For instance, Sake would have fallen on Wednesday if it was not for the involvement of MONUSCO, because MONUSCO was fighting alongside the Congolese army against these proxy forces. MONUSCO was very, very instrumental in repelling them from taking over Sake on Wednesday. So we can't just, the government is being irresponsible, though, by this language of constantly calling on MONUSCO to leave. I mean, what do they have better as a replacement for MONUSCO? I'm not calling for MONUSCO to stay, but it's very responsible for the government to keep saying this, and the population is eating this up, thinking that the problem is MONUSCO. The problem is not with MONUSCO. The problem is with the government, which is unable to defend the sovereignty of its own country.
Do we know the status of the SADC forces that were meant to come and help?
Well, again, this is what I'm saying, is that, you know, we could call all the forces we want. We could call Burundi if we want to call Burundi. We can call SADC forces if we want to call SADC forces. But SADC forces are not going to fight in the place of the Congolese people. The Congolese government needs to give a reason to the armed forces to fight. And it's not like the Congolese armies cannot fight. But, you know, when you are fighting with your hands tied in the back, it's a very, very big problem. We have a pretty good army, but they need the support to be able to conduct this war. You know, I think it's a tragedy what is happening in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And again, I'm calling on the government to be more responsible, because what happened in Kinshasa today is partly because of what happened. You read the communique from the embassy of Cote d'Ivoire. You know, there was attacks on MONUSCO forces. There was attack on a vehicle from the Ivory Coast. And, you know, there was an attack on a television station called Canal Police. You know, it's not their fault. The government needs to take the bull by the horn.
Malenga Sindra is the president of the Center for Political and Strategic Studies in DRC and a former spokesperson for President Joseph Kabila. He spoke with me from Kansas City.
The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments on whether or not former U.S. President Donald Trump should appear on the 2024 election ballot, plus an analysis of the latest developments in the Middle East. Listen this weekend on VOA's Issues in the News.
Uganda's government is working with the International Organization for Migration to secure the release and repatriation of Ugandans allegedly held hostage by rebel groups in Myanmar. Some opposition members say there are hundreds of Ugandan hostages, but the government says it has details of only 30 nationals. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala, Uganda.
Opposition lawmaker Muada Nkunyingyi is calling on the government to expedite the release of Ugandans thought to be held hostage by rebel groups in Myanmar. Muada says he started receiving calls from the relatives of the hostages late last year.
The number of Ugandans from our counting is 450, and they are likely to be more. The matter at hand is urgent. These are Ugandans in the hands of rebels. We must look at remedial and urgent measures to rescue these stranded Ugandans. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs and our embassies ought to give regular and timely travel advice to Ugandans.
Prime Minister Robinah Nabbanja says government has confirmed that many Ugandans and nationals of other countries were lured to Thailand by ads for high-paying jobs posted on fictitious websites. Instead, they were taken to Myanmar, allegedly to fight for rebel groups. It's unclear how long they have been held or if there are ransom demands. Many of them are younger people with technology skills.
However, International Organization for Migration promised that they are going to help us get in touch with the government of Myanmar and see how our youth can be rescued, because they have rescued some. I'm told in Uganda here they have rescued like four.
John Molimba, Uganda's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, met last month with Myanmar government officials.
It was agreed that Uganda and Myanmar establishes bilateral relations and create cooperation frameworks in immigration and anti-human trafficking, among others.
Government officials say they are collecting information on the hostages to help locate them. It is asking family members to let them know how they left the country and the people they were in contact with before leaving. Uganda's high unemployment, especially among the youth, has forced many to seek jobs in other countries. Available statistics indicate more than 200,000 Ugandans left the country to work in the Middle East between 2016 and 2022. But many who left illegally are undocumented, and it is not known where they went. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Senegal's political crisis deepened as a second person died Saturday in increasingly violent protests against President Macky Sall's decision to postpone upcoming presidential elections. The latest violence has brought fresh condemnations from opposition leaders, some of whom were candidates for the presidency. A new round of protests is planned for Tuesday. The French news agency AFP says a market vendor, Madugwe, 23, died Saturday after having been shot the previous day during clashes in the capital Dakar. Already on Friday, a 22-year-old second-year geography student died in the northern town of St. Louis in circumstances that are still not clear. In St. Louis, Alpha Yaro Tonkara died on the campus of Gaston Borgo University, where he was studying geography. 100 of his classmates held an all-night vigil for him. Videos posted on social media suggest other people were also wounded. The city's prosecutor's office said it had opened an investigation into the death. The Interior Ministry, however, issued a statement denying that security forces had been operating on the university campus. The leader of South Africa's third largest political party promised Saturday to create jobs for millions of the country's unemployed and turn around its economy as he seeks to attract more voters ahead of much-anticipated general election. The French news agency AFP reports that Economic Freedom Fighters Party founder Julius Malema addressed a packed 56,000-capacity Moses Madiba Stadium in the coastal city of Durban as he launched the party's election manifesto to the delight of supporters. With election season well underway in South Africa, most political parties that have launched their manifestos are expected to do so in the coming weeks. A date for the election has not been announced. AFP says the election is expected to be highly contested because the ruling ANC, which has governed the country since 1994, faces a lot of challenges. The EFF is popular among disenchanted South Africans, especially youth, due to its radical policies. Malema is a controversial figure who largely divides opinion for his radical proposals to solve the country's problems. However, he continues to enjoy widening popularity in South Africa and increasingly across Africa. A former ANC youth leader who was expelled from the party, Malema is now among the ruling party's staunchest critics. His party garnered 10% of the national vote in the country's 2019 elections to become the third largest opposition party. Buoyed by the decline in support for the ANC, which has governed South Africa since 1994, the party expects to increase support in the upcoming elections. Recent polls by polling firms Ipsos, released this week, estimated the EFF could perform better in the upcoming polls and replace the Democratic Alliance as the second biggest party in the country. The same polls also suggest that ANC may dip under 50% of electoral support in what is expected to be the ruling party's toughest elections yet. Cameroon separatist fighters Wednesday claimed responsibility for the killing of four government workers, including a policeman, abducted Tuesday in the country's restive English-speaking northwest region. Government officials say two of the hostages, including a government official, the military freed, are responding to treatment in a hospital. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaounde that the abduction and killing followed renewed separatist attacks that have claimed several dozen civilians within 2 weeks.
Cameroon on Wednesday said one of its officials, who had been abducted Tuesday evening in the restive English-speaking northwest region bordering Nigeria, has been freed by government troops. Nicholas Nkongo Manchang, the divisional officer for the region's Bamenda 2nd District, was kidnapped at gunpoint with five others, including a policeman, on their way to an official ceremony in Kambek Town, the government said. Deben Chofo, governor of the Northwest Region, told a crowd in Kambek Wednesday that Manchang and another captive were freed after a swift military operation.
The head of state instructed the security services to set free the hostages. 4 hours later, the state administrative authority was free, thanks to the bravery of our military as well as the bravery of the abducted victims. Authorities, living forces, continue providing military with all information to free the hostages that are not yet released.
Chofo said the divisional officer, known locally as D.O., and the other freed captive are responding to treatment in a hospital in Bamenda, where they were rushed to by government troops. Christopher Achobang is a spokesperson for the Ambazonia Governing Council fighting for independence for Cameroon's English-speaking regions from the French-majority country. Achobang said Manchang saved his life by escaping.
The D.O. staged an escape because he fell into a ravine, and the fighters were not so ready to get into the ravine to rescue him, so they left him there, wounded and dying. He escaped and walked for a long distance, where Cameroon military then found him and took him to an helicopter which evacuated the D.O. to Bamenda.
Achobang said separatist fighters should have killed the D.O. if he didn't escape. English-speaking separatists say they consider divisional officers who are heads of districts to be government troops because they undergo military training and as such constitute a legitimate target to fighters. But Cameroon government officials say divisional officers are civil administrators who represent the Yaounde central government and work for the development of their districts. Government troops say Manchang drove past the military-led convoy of government officials traveling to Nkambe and fell into an ambush mounted by fighters. Manchang has not explained why he left the convoy. Separatists say after Manchang escaped, four companions, including a police officer, were killed. The Ambazonia Governing Council said the separatist forces killed the captives to send a message to government troops that claims the separatists fighting for an independent English-speaking state have been defeated are unfounded. The government and military have not commented on the alleged killing of the four captives, but on Wednesday night, separatists shared pictures of four dead bodies on social media, including Facebook and WhatsApp. VOA could not independently verify the authenticity of the pictures. Civilians, however, say the pictures appear to be those of the abducted government workers. Cameroon has, within the past 2 weeks, reported that separatists killed several dozen people in northwestern towns, including Bamenda, Kumbo and Dop. The government says at least 11 separatists were killed in military raids in Kumbo and Oku, both northwestern towns. Separatists acknowledge their fighters were killed and say several government troops also died in fighting. Edward Nfor is a member of the Cameroon Civil Society Group and a road contractor working in the northwest region. He says the current wave of abductions and killings is either unreported or underreported by local media that fear persecution from rebels and the Cameroon government.
Killings are on the rise. Kidnapping is on the rise. If heavily guarded government officials are kidnapped, then what about the ordinary civilian? People are moving, but they can't move freely. These boys will go out to the village, get out people and say that they are supporting the military and execute them in public. Let government try to do something and get this thing to an end.
Mfor said several dozen people have either been abducted or killed since fresh attacks began in January. Separatists on social media say they will not spare anyone who reports fighters hiding in towns and villages to government troops. The separatist conflict broke out in 2016 when Anglophone Cameroonians protested discrimination by the Francophone majority. The United Nations says more than 6,000 people have been killed and the unrest has deprived 600,000 children of education. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Recent weeks have witnessed a surge in violence in the contested region of Abyei, claimed by both Sudan and South Sudan. The latest wave of intercommunal attacks has resulted in the burning of villages, the death of dozens of people, including peacekeepers and humanitarian workers, and the displacement of thousands of civilians. To explore the underlying factors fueling the conflict in Abyei and potential solutions, VOA's Nabil Biagio spoke with Joshua Kreis, a South Sudan and South Sudan researcher who authored the past paper last year titled Attacked from Both Sides, Abyei's Existential Dilemma.
It's a very tragic situation. We have to remember that Abyei has been waiting for a political resolution to its future now for over a decade. It was promised a referendum to run concurrently with the South Sudanese referendum on whether it wanted to join South Sudan, and it never got that referendum. Instead, it was invaded by the Sudanese army, and the Sudanese army have never left the north of the territory. So while the Nok Dinka, the area's residents, did get to move back to central Abyei, they never moved back to their villages in the north. Instead, what we saw is SAF taking up positions in the north of Abyei, and though there is a UN peacekeeping force, UNISFA, that's supposed to patrol and ensure the protection of civilians in a demilitarized Abyei, that force has never attempted to actually demilitarize the north. And so the people of Abyei have never been allowed to go back to the north. That was the situation up to 2022. And then the Mok were attacked from the south as well. Their very close compatriots, the Twitch Dinka, attacked them coming up from Warap State, looking to control the market at Egok, and control the humanitarian hub of Egok. And that was important because Egok was where the people fled from Abyei town when the Sudanese army invaded in 2011. Now, in theory, according to Twitch authorities, that's a territory that is claimed by the Twitch, but there has been a ruling on the territory of Abyei, and it's very clear that Egok is inside the territory of Abyei as it was given by the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague. So we really have to see this attack as an economic claim to try to take control of Egok's market. These attacks started, remember, in 2022. They've raised the market. They've displaced the population from the south of Abyei.
That's a net market, correct?
Yes, that's a net market, yeah. The reason for this is that the Twitch themselves are a marginalized community in terms of Wara. After Bonapenek left the governorship, they haven't felt themselves as strongly represented either in national government or in state government as other stronger Dinka sections within Wara. So they've really attacked a weaker, or what they took it as a weak Mok Dinka stuck between Sudan and South Sudan. So it's one marginalized group preying on another, and that was the overall situation, the struggle for economic control of the net market and of Egok. The recent violence, last week, South Sudan's President Salva Kiir gave an order that Guy Meshek, who's a Bul Nur prophet, should leave Twitch County. Now, Guy Meshek has relatives among the Twitch, and he's also close to his other relative, Stephen Boy, the rebel leader. And he has been considered a threat by the Bulnua leadership. And as we know, the Bulnua constitute not just the county commissioner, but also the security advisor of Salva Kiir, Tupac Lua, and also the governor of Unity, Nguyen Mon Thuy, and of course his brother, Bapin Mon Thuy. So they thought that Guy was a threat, and they wanted to push him back into Mayom and remove his sanctuary in Twitch County. And what this led to was a more general movement against the Nuer, both in Abyei Town, which led to some disputes in the market, but also that led to a protest by the Twitch, who didn't want Guy Meshek to leave because he's been fighting for them against the Ngoc in Abyei, among other things. And so instead you've got an attack, you've got attacks in the south of Abyei, this sort of militaristic, belligerent stance by the Twitch that Guy Meshek should not leave, and you also got the attack of the returnees in Abyeimnom, on the border between the Ruweng administrative area and Unity. So we saw a series of violent attacks during the current conflict, really triggered by this executive order of Salva Kiir to have Guy Meshek return to Mayom County.
So yes, that explains the recent uptick in violence there, but attacks on Abyei and the Abyei people have been going on for some time. Like you mentioned, they began last year. Why does this issue seem so chronic, and Juba is seemingly unable to resolve it?
Well, I think it's not just that Juba's unable to resolve it. I think we have to see that a lot of Juba's attempts to resolve it have made the situation worse.
That's Joshua Kreis, a Sudan and South Sudan researcher who authored a paper last year titled Attacked from Both Sides, Abyei's Existential Dilemma. He was speaking with my colleague Nabil Biagio from New York. A meeting among six African Union member states to discuss Africa's feed and fodder crisis is underway in Nairobi, Kenya. Having enough feed for livestock is critical to the food security of many countries on the continent. Some farmers are considering adopting a Chinese-engineered grass called jiankao, advertised as a high-yielding and fast-maturing. Francis Ontomwa has more from Kajiado in Kenya.
In the heart of Kitengela town, 25 kilometers south of Kenya's capital, Nairobi, this vegetation dotting the landscape first appeared 4 years ago. It's a grass developed by the Chinese called jiankao. Chinese state media describes it as magic grass. Chinese entrepreneur Jack Liu grows jiankao grass in Kenya and sells it to farmers here.
Jiankao grass is tall and erect. It's a hybrid from 38 kinds of varieties of grasses.
Liu says jiankao can survive even in the harshest of climate conditions, provided it has irrigation. Dairy farmer Stephen Mwangi started feeding it to his cows a year ago.
They are growing, how they are doing, very fast, growing very fast. They are putting weight like a kilo a day when you start feeding them.
Mwangi says jiankao provides more nutrients for his cattle. He noticed dairy production has also increased. When compared to other types of fodder he's used in the past, he says jiankao has a greater yield than napier grass, a common fodder. He harvests the grass at least 5 times a year. Kenya can only produce 40% of its fodder needs, the government estimates. Six African Union countries met in February to discuss fodder supplies challenges. Pockets of farmers in Kenya are looking to jiankao as a solution. Liu sells silage of fermented grass at $7 a bag. He also sells stems at 12 cents each for planting. Farmers say jiankao is cheaper than the alternative napier grass.
Jiankao grass can be used for cattle, sheep and goat, poultry, even fish. Particularly jiankao grass, because of its high crude protein, used for dairy farming, it helps increasing milking about 30 up to 50%, reducing the fodder cost over 50%.
In 2021, The Kenya Plant Health Inspectorate Service, a regulatory body, allowed Liu's company to add more fields and expand to grow Junkao grass after ruling out the risks of pests and invasive species. But some scientists are urging caution and say solving one challenge could lead to another problem. Ornithologist John Musina worries cultivating Junkao will interfere with biodiversity.
Half of our bird species in Kenya occur in our rangelands. Now, if you convert large chunks of these rangelands into Junkao grass fields, even if they are small holdings that multiply and change the landscape of our rangelands, then immediately what you've done is that you have reduced the habitat available for the native species of plants and animals. And this loss of habitat, coupled with degradation of this habitat, means that there is biodiversity loss.
A solution is not to depend on just one kind of grass, says botanist Joyce Jeffua.
We might have to look at how we can integrate our natural grass, indigenous grass, like buffalo grass is also good for livestock. So if you have bands of Junkao grass intercropped with indigenous grass, that might reduce the risks of losing the rangeland biodiversity or even the farmland biodiversity.
With climate change and drought ravaging parts of the country, some Kenyan farmers like Mwangi are embracing Junkao as a lifeline for their livestock. Francis Ontomwa, VOA News, Kajiado, Kenya.
Hi, this is Larry London, and I'm on Border Crossings every single day of the week. But Tuesdays are a special day on Border Crossings when we bring you the artist spotlight of the week. Some of the great music makers who have joined us, some big names and some not so big names that are up and comers, like Anna and Louise, who are in Grief Cat. We will hear their story this coming up Tuesday. Make sure you tune us in right here at 1500 Universal Border Crossings on VOA Africa.
A 22-year-old Zimbabwean with cerebral palsy is hoping to compete in the 2024 Special Olympics Canada Winter Games in Calgary from February 27th to March 2nd. Meanwhile, groups that advocate for disabled people's rights are working to turn government policy into law. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, Zimbabwe.
In Ufakose Township in Harare, Zimbabwe, Tapiwa Nashe, Prince Mutsikira spends his time running and training students at his former school, some of whom have disabilities. Mutsikira, a 22-year-old runner with cerebral palsy, hopes his hard work will help him qualify to represent Zimbabwe in track competitions at the 2024 Special Olympics Canada Winter Games in Calgary from February 27 to March 2. In the coming days, he will take part in Special Olympics training to test his athletic abilities for participation in the games. He says he will be excited to get a chance to compete at the Olympics. He tells his colleagues that they can do the same, that with their disabilities, they can also compete and they should not look down on themselves. He maintains a positive outlook despite having cerebral palsy, a group of disorders that affect a person's ability to move and maintain balance and posture. His grandmother, Tambudzai Ruzizonyariri, who began caring for Mutsikiram when he was 3, says at one point she could not imagine her grandson training and competing like this. She says the family has since learned that her grandson does a lot of stuff and they thank God for his positive attitude toward life. He is only 22 and is training other children living with disabilities. It's unbelievable. Zimbabwe statistics say that of its population of 16 million people, more than 1.4 million have a disability. Now, organizations of people with disabilities in Zimbabwe are pushing for the passage of legislation that would make law some recommendations based on the government's disability policy launched in 2021. Advocates say the current law, the Disabled Persons Act of 1992, is falling short. Peter Barry heads Sight Savers, an advocacy group for disabled people.
If the bill is passed into law, it means so many other services that they are not accessing at the moment will be accessible. Because at the moment, our current act at the moment is outdated.
Zimbabwe's policy says disabled people should have equal rights to employment, education, and health, among other things. Government officials say some provisions of the National Disability Policy are being implemented. Christine Peter is Director of Disability Affairs in Zimbabwe's Ministry of Public Service, Labour and Social Welfare.
The government of Zimbabwe has now set up a National Technical Committee on Disability Inclusion. This committee has representatives from all the 26 government ministries. It has representatives from organizations of persons with disabilities and our development partners as well.
Meanwhile, Mutsigira says he will keep pushing ahead and encouraging other persons with disabilities to do the same. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Coming up in the second half, Night in Africa, sports. A commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN and Secretary General for Political Affairs, and music from African Collection. And now in Nightline Africa Sports, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hi, Samson.
Hi Douglas, and good evening sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports, reaching you from the Stade Olympique Alassane Ouattara de Mbimpe, where the finals of the 2023 Africa Cup of Nations will be played. All is now set for the final. After a month of competition, the most thrilling African in recent memory has thrown up a fascinating heavyweight final showdown between two of West Africa football powerhouses. The Super Eagles of Nigeria and host Elephants of Cote d'Ivoire will battle for the coveted trophy. 11 years after they were crowned continental champions, Nigeria are aiming to win their fourth title and in doing so match the tally of old rivals Ghana. Only Egypt with 7 and Cameroon with 5 have won the Cup of Nations more often. Head coach of the Super Eagles, Jose Pissarro, says he wants to win the African title both for himself and for Nigeria.
Tough match, good team, one favorite for this competition since the first day. Only one thing, we want to win. I want to win this match. It's my focus. I don't think anything more. Do my best with my team, of course, for beat Cote d'Ivoire.
Captain of the Nigerian side, Ahmed Musa, who is one of the only two players in the squad that won the 2013 title, says the team is looking good to clinch the title.
Yeah, for me, I think this is one of my best AFCON. A lot of surprises since from the beginning of the start to the end. I think the most important thing is just to win the game. For me, it's just the most important is just to win and encourage them. Anything can happen tomorrow and nobody knows what is going to happen.
Ivory Coast, meanwhile, will match Nigeria on 3 titles if they emerge victorious at the Cup of Nations for the first time since 2015. The Elephants are the first host nation to make it to the final since 2006 when Egypt defeated Ivorians on penalties in Cairo to take the trophy. Sebastian Haller told journalists during the pre-match conference that it will be a pleasant experience to win the AFCON on home soil.
You play Africa Cup in your own country. You have a lot of people that just pushing you, support you every day. So it gives you the strength to just perform. So that's a beautiful thing. And I hope that this good pressure will bring my country to the top.
Interim coach Emerson Fay thinks it will be a tough game, but his players are mentally and physically prepared for the challenge.
We almost went out of the competition, so this brought us closer and led us to the performances that you saw. Right now, we're all focused, eyes on the final. I believe the main lesson that we have drawn from the game, the group stage game against Nigeria, is that in this competition, you have to expect the unexpected.
Some journalists covering the 2023 AFCON told Nightline Africa Sports that the final would be too close to call, but had mixed predictions on who will be crowned champion.
Cote d'Ivoire is going to win 2-1 for Ivory Coast. Why? Because the team is better than the Nigeria team.
The two teams have worked very hard to get to this position. They were in the same group, you know, at the beginning. It's going to be a very interesting game, but I think it'll be decided after regulation time, and Nigeria will take the...
And that's it for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports from the Stade Olympic de Mbimpe Alassane Ouattara in Abidjan, Cote d'Ivoire. And it's back to you, Douglas.
Thanks, Samson. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa. Now, let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. And here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN and Secretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. ECOWAS management, especially its management of peacekeeping and peacemaking, have come under severe criticism in the past few months. This is regrettable because ECOWAS' peacekeeping role has played a critical role in the sub-region. Through its creditable and inspiring leadership, ECOMOG was created. And without ECOMOG and its activities, particularly in Liberia and Sierra Leone, it could have been a difficult period for the sub-region. And it must be remembered that when ECOMOG and ECOWAS played their role, they did it by themselves. They did not run to the United Nations for help, nor did they look on any major power to be involved. What has caused the problem for ECOWAS in the recent months? What is performance after the coup d'etat in Niger? Unlike past practice, ECOWAS stepped out in a belligerent mood. It talked about intervention and went on mobilization of forces. And inevitable, there was a pushback all around, and ECOWAS had to retrace its steps. Otherwise, ECOWAS seems to be regaining its steps. But there are problems facing ECOWAS. For example, the decision of some countries to withdraw may be due to disquiet over the role it played in Niger. It was a very dangerous move. At a time when foreign forces were in Niger, it appeared to many that ECOWAS were preparing the ground for an easy entry by these foreign forces. We should all be happy that things have ended differently. Peace was restored. So to those who are saying that ECOWAS must confine itself solely to the economic and social matters for which it was created, they should say that this is the wrong move. What is required now is good review of ECOWAS and to allow ECOWAS to play its role, particularly in the peacemaking role, which it played excellently in the case of Mali, in the case of Sierra Leone, even recently, and the case of Gambia, when it prevented civil war by arranging a decent exit for the former president, who is now in Equatorial Guinea. ECOWAS must return to those periods when it was negotiating with African members and tried to bring them back to full control of the country without bloodshed. They should abandon the non-African move of making threats, which is still evident, because when a member decided to withdraw, while foreign ministers of ECOWAS were talking about negotiations. There were those in ECOWAS who were predicting dire circumstances for those states. I am hopeful that, for example, the case going on right now in Senegal, that by quiet diplomacy, ECOWAS could help the parties to avoid a deteriorating political system. It is true that ECOWAS problems of financing, but it's possible for the members to try to see how far they can go to finance their operation. Because it was when ECOWAS went to the Security Council to secure financing and logistics, and then were rebuffed, and that opened the door for France to take its own unilateral measures to get into Mali. And it became so difficult for France that it had to call in the United Nations. But what was key is that ECOWAS was sidelined. So reform of ECOWAS is essential, but there is no reason for ECOWAS to abandon its peacemaking and peacekeeping role, particularly at a very dangerous period in the Sahel, where the quiet diplomacy and excellent peacekeeping management can save the sub-region. It is enough to go beyond the reliance of outside powers in the maintenance of peace and security in the sub-region. I thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. I'll stand here on Nightline Africa, and it's the time we get to relax and reflect with music.
A celebration day, medication day, a celebration day, in Africa.
I go down and swear for you. When my name be what your lips they mention, I will be right by you. Enemies, no progression. Let me watch our moves. Doubting me never got ever. Baby, I gonna need your Google. And I know what you thinking, so I go try a little harder. All these things that I'm doing, only to get you to love my mother. Hey. So you can bring on your girlfriends, so we party harder. And you can tell them I'm your best friend. You to the market, treat you like a lady, like a lady, like a lady. Oh, I go go river, I go come carry water, I go full up the gen set for the power. Treat you like a lady, like a baby, like a lady. Oh, girl, I don't say you doubt me, so I go try a little harder. All these things I keep doing, only to get you to love my mother. And you can bring on your GM.
And that was our Sunday Music Spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Join us again on Saturday. Wish you a fruitful week.